Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our conversation with the much-loved, admired actor, director and Bell Shakespeare founder, John Bell. We meet at a time when brave and visionary, compassionate and singular leadership is almost entirely missing from our political landscape, and it's pretty hard to find anywhere else. What does it mean to lead, and what can the artist who has inspired and driven John all of his creative life, William Shakespeare, teach us about how we can lead? John's new book is called Some Achieve Greatness, Lessons on Leadership from Shakespeare and from one of his greatest admirers. That's him. That's John. I'm Virginia Trioli from ABC Television and Radio, and I'm delighted to be with you in what John believes is a conversation today. He thinks he gets to ask me questions too, but we'll see about that. We're meeting on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'd like to acknowledge them as the traditional custodians of these lands for tens of thousands of years, and I pay my respects to them, their elders past and present. We didn't get, because of COVID reasons, we had to be here beforehand. So we didn't get the proper, you know, entrance on stage that someone as important and delightful as John gets. John, would you just stand so we can just do that stage entrance? And you can all applaud him as he is here. Come on. That's what I wanted. That's all I wanted. Hello, John. Lovely to see you.
Hi, Junior.
Was William Shakespeare himself a good leader?
I think, as far as we can put together the facts from his life, his biography, he was a rather exceptional leader in a fairly quiet way, not a bellicose one, but for someone who formed his own theatre company and made it the leading company of the day, that takes quite some doing. He worked with several different companies as a young trainee actor and writer, the Lord Chamberlain's men and the Admiral's men. But then he and some sharers created the company that became the Queen's men. Queen Elizabeth adopted them as her private theatre company. So they were obliged to perform for her at court as well as playing at the Globe in London. And when she died, they were taken over by King James I and they became the King's men. So they were the primary theatre company in the country for all that time under those two monarchs, and Shakespeare was the leading writer, actor and director of the company. People don't realise he was an actor as well, but if you look at the works of Ben Jonson, there's a copy in the Fisher Library, the Mitchell Library in Sydney, the title page says actors in these comedies were William Shakespeare, Richard Burbage, down the line, and then you turn the page, actors in these tragedies were William Shakespeare, Richard Burbage, and the line of names. So he was a leading actor in other people's plays as well as his own. And he seemed to have played the kings and the dukes, those sort of more solemn roles. I don't think he was a great comedian by the sound of it.
Do we know, is there any documentation of whether people liked working with or for him?
Yes, indeed. He seems to have been very popular. He was known as Gentle Mr. Shakespeare and a Sweet Mr. Shakespeare, so that's pretty good epithets. And when he died, his friends in the company collected all his works and they published the first folio, for which we are ever grateful. If they hadn't bothered to collect all the papers and put them together and edit them, we would never have had the folio, because he didn't bother publishing it himself. Unlike Ben Jonson, who collected his works and published them as my collected works, and that caused a bit of laughter around the place. How dare a playwright call his stuff works? It's just scripts. But he published them as works, and so Shakespeare's friends thought that he deserved at least the same kind of exposure, and they published Shakespeare's first folio. And so he's obviously popular with his colleagues. Mm. He took that trouble to preserve his memory and wrote a number of glowing testimonials to him in that first folio. When you open it up, the first six pages or so are just testimonials from fellow friends and poets and playwrights, including Ben Jonson, who could be quite bitchy at times and quite narky. But he says, this was the sweet swan of Avon. He was the soul, the soul of our age, soul of our time, as great as the Roman tragedians and comedians. So, you know, held in very high esteem.
Let's step back a bit. Where did your love of Shakespeare begin? Do you remember that moment?
I do very clearly. It was in high school at the Maitland Maris Brothers. not a citadel of culture, as I recall. but when I was about, I must have been about 13, I guess, and the English master strode into the room and chucked down a copy of Midsummer Night's Dream on each desk. But instead of asking us to read it out loud, he performed the play for us. He would march up and down the aisles, declaiming all the parts, describing the costumes, the scenery, the pratfalls, all the funny business, and acting all the roles with great gusto. He was a terrific bottom. He was very persuasive. his Titania, Queen of the Fairies, was a little less convincing. He was the football coach as well as the English master, so he had some bulk behind him. But so he made the play. He turned the script into theatre. And we couldn't wait for the next English lesson and the next chapter, as it were, of Midsummer Night's Dream. And then he marched us off to the cinema to see the Olivia movies. And if any live theatre came to town, he would take us all down to the town hall to see that. And I was ever grateful for seeing live performance. There wasn't much of that happening around Maitland. So thanks to him and his successor, who saw me through my senior high school years, who was also a lover of theatre and poetry and Shakespeare, those two men really moulded my ambition and my love of theatre and of Shakespeare. And I wish they were still alive so I could say thank you properly, because at the time you don't. You take that for granted and think, oh, that's what they're there for.
It's a beautiful
promote me.
It's a beautiful example of leadership, isn't it? I imagine everyone in this room will have that person, maybe not in, you know, for theatre or for Shakespeare, but will have that teacher who opened that door and who created that spark. I've always wondered if they're aware at the time that they are doing that. I know they become aware because, you know, we seek them out later on, or at least I hope we do, and write the letter or make the call and go and say thank you for what you did. But I wonder if they're aware in that moment.
I think we all should make a habit of doing that. If they're still around, we should go and see them and say thank you. You've changed my life. You've created my life. But I didn't do it enough, I'm afraid. As I say, one's rather blasé at that age. You just take that for granted. And I regret I didn't say thank you enough after many years later.
And in hindsight, that's true leadership, what he said.
Absolutely.
The leadership that you've shown yourself is really interesting. And starting, you know, two theatre companies, which you did, which is, you know, enormously brave and a startling act of leadership itself. Is that how it seemed at the time for you?
Perhaps foolhardy rather than brave, but necessary. When I came back from England in 1970, I felt a great urge to create some new Australian theatre. There wasn't a great deal happening then at the time, not in Sydney. Melbourne, you had the Pram Factory had got off the ground, and they were doing new Australian work of a very interesting and radically different calibre. But in Sydney, we didn't have much of that. We'd had the Summer of the 17th Doll, and not much since. So my partner and I, Ken Haller, we created the little Nimrod Theatre in Nimrod Street in King's Cross just to promote new Australian writing and new Australian plays. That grew into something bigger. But it just seemed necessary that we encourage new writing. And even with the classics, we did some Shakespeare and other classics, but with an Australian flavour. I thought we can't treat these as foreign objects. We have to make them part of our language, part of our culture as well.
So for you, what defines the best qualities of leadership?
I made a little list, just in case I forgot any. I won't go through the whole list, but among them, I would say, I think empathy is one of the great ones, to listen, but to really listen, not just to half listen, but to really listen to what's being said and even to what's not being said, and try and dig out what people really want from you. I think empathy is probably one of the main things, and that's maybe where one's work as an actor helps, because you spend your whole life trying to get inside other people's skins and see what makes them tick. So listening, empathy is huge. Leading from the front, but as part of the team. So collaboration has always been a big thing for me. I worked for too many directors as a young actor who were dictatorial, autocratic, and sort of imposed a production on the actors, whereas I've always enjoyed much more the directors who entice a performance out of an actor and encourage the whole troupe to create something rather than I am the auteur. I think that collaboration is a really important part of
the work.
Can
I jump in there? Because in the book there's a really interesting discussion where you talk about coaxing a performance, a great word, coaxing a great performance from an actor rather than dictating it. But John spends some time talking about how you physically create the space in which everyone is able, at a company, at a business, in a theatre troupe, to contribute and to be heard, and whether that's a round circle, but if there's too many of you, the circle is too big. And if it's a room like this, you know, who wants to walk up to the microphone and ask the question? You'll all be asked to do that later on. And you really wrestle with that problem of the physical impediments to true collaboration.
Yes, I've certainly found if people sit at a table with someone at the head of the table, then they're automatically the voice
person
of authority.
In charge,
so to try to break that up in as whatever way as possible. And with a small group, that's quite likely. You can sit in a small circle and everybody is equal. Make the circle too big and people are frightened to speak out because that's the distance frightens them. So I've spent a lot of time with company meetings trying to work out the ideal way that everybody feels empowered and entitled and equally valid.
Mm. Go on with your list.
Sorry?
Go on with your list.
Oh, my list. Sorry.
We'll take a couple more because then I want him to do something more exciting.
Risk-taking is important, but not rashness. To take calculated risks. Otherwise, you just stay stuck in the one place. Calculated risks and try to foresee several stops ahead where that might lead you, not just the next stop, but the one after that and the one after that. Is important if you can encourage that kind of foresight. It's important to listen to experts, take advice from older and smarter people than yourself, and always try to work with people who are better than you are because that's the only way you learn. And I've always tried to really, as an actor, try to find the best directors and take something from each of them to put into my own work.
What about people who are younger and smarter than yourself?
You listen to them too. You have to listen to everybody. Yeah, a lot of younger people are much smarter than I am, but you have to be prepared to not only give them a voice, but also admit, okay, I was wrong, that was the old way of doing things. Your way is, this is different now. You're quicker, you're smarter. That's welcome aboard.
Could you read us from your book an example of what we're talking about here? We spoke, John and I, before we came here about perhaps a speech from Shakespeare that might represent those qualities in leadership that are meaningful. And I think, did we agree on one in the end?
Well, yes. I guess I should introduce it a little by saying, well, who are Shakespeare's ideal leaders? Who are his best leaders and his worst ones? And I think probably Henry V comes off as the most ideal leader in that he's the most inspiring. Shakespeare is pretty open-minded about Henry because he doesn't pull back on saying that he was creating a war for purely political reasons, a quite unjustified war, which cost a lot in lives and treasure. He was fairly bullying about getting the church on side and getting everybody on side to create this campaign. So Shakespeare doesn't spare him. And even the possibility of his being a war criminal in his slaughter of French prisoners. Some would say that was an expedient thing, a necessary thing to do. Others would say, no, that was really quite a serious war crime. So all those things are in the mix. There's no one ideal leader. But as I said, Henry V is the most inspiring in the way he can communicate to people, and that's what makes him tick. So we see examples early on where he's leading the troops at Harfleur and very aggressive speeches like Once More Into the Breach, Dear Friends, and later on other speeches of a similar tone that are brutal and quite xenophobic about the French. Brutal speeches, a bit like a really, you know, rugged football coach at half-time, sort of whatever it takes to get you over the top. But when it comes to the Battle of Agincourt, he has to adapt. It has to be different because he's leading this troop of hungry, worn-out soldiers against a French army five times the size, and it looks like a total wipeout is going to be the result. So he has to sort of switch his tone and not be bellicose or aggressive or bullying, but something that is more collaborative, as I said, encouraging, play low status, invite them all, know all their names, make them your brothers. And I guess the biggest trick of all is to convince them that this is going to be a fantastic experience. like they know it's going to be, it could be a wipeout. He says it will be for some of you, but for those who survive, your names will live forever. This will go down in history, and thanks to Shakespeare, it has done just that. But to be able to sell them that you are actually lucky to be here, and people at home will wish they were here because it's going to be such a fantastic experience. I think that's the most brilliant sell I've ever heard.
Yeah, really.
But just to give you the speech, here we go. So he needs some excuse to speak, and he lights on the idea that this is the feast day of two very obscure saints called Saint Crispin and Saint Crispian. And he takes that as a starting point, and then he keeps hammering that this day, this day, this is the day. He keeps hammering that one theme, a bit like Obama, yes we can, yes we can. That little phrase, he keeps introducing it to really inspire them. So I'll just give you the speech. This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when this day is named and rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall live this day and see old age will yearly on the vigil feast his neighbours and say, tomorrow is Saint Crispian. Then will he strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's day. Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in his mouth as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so vile. This day will gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England now abed will think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day. There's a good sell for you, isn't it?
I've never had anyone, I don't think ever in my life, make a truly inspirational speech, a speech of great leadership like that, and like others that I've, you know, been lucky enough to hear, as we all have on the TV or through history, but, you know, to me, to a group that I've been part of, which means you sort of have to, you have to seek it out yourself, in a sense, you know, the leadership. You've got to somehow identify it and find it in individuals who might be around you, and almost sort of start that leadership group yourselves and together.
Yes, that's a very good point. That it's a matter of empowering people, not just I am the boss, I'm the leader, but you are all part of this. You are all individually going to make this project, whatever it is, work. And that's a very good point.
See, I think I don't do that. I don't think that I ever see the job that I do or the jobs that I do or the role that I have as actually being that of a leader. And I know that I actively shy away from what I might formalise as, you know, the leadership position, you know, in the office or, you know, at the ABC or in the team that I'm working in. I sort of resist that. Is that cowardice? is there a Shakespeare character for that?
I think if there's some little project within the office you want to achieve something, it might be sort of like a charity raffle or something. Someone's got to organise it and you've got to enthuse people. So even the tiniest thing like that, you can find qualities of leadership about inclusiveness and welcoming people and inspiring them and you know, making them feel that they are contributing something important. No matter how small, I think everybody, teachers need great qualities of leadership, I think, need to cultivate them because their responsibility is enormous.
Did you write this book now? Because these ideas about the leadership qualities in Shakespeare have been percolating in you for a while. Or is it because of the times that we're in?
Well, the book happened because I've been doing a bit of after dinner speaking for very corporate situations, and they talk about leadership, and I think, well, I don't know much about leadership, but I know of people who were great leaders, and I know about Shakespeare. So I had the idea of not talking with a whiteboard or about talking about Winston Churchill or Abraham Lincoln, but characters from Shakespeare, and I could quote them and perform speeches from them, which people enjoyed hearing, as well as analysing them as if they were real people. And that went down well at these sort of corporate functions. And at one of those, there was John Green, who was the CEO of Pantera Press, and said to me, well, if you'd like to write that down, I'll publish it. And that's how it happened.
But what's remarkable in what you just said, I've got to pull you up on that, John. I mean, you started that answer there, that sentence by saying, well, I don't know anything about leadership. I mean, that's astonishing. You founded John Bell Shakespeare Company.
Yeah.
you have led troops. I mean TROUPS. And led people and worked on lessons of leadership yourself. You've succeeded. You've failed. You've got up again. Did you really not see yourself as knowing anything about that?
Well, I guess one's a bit shy about saying I am the expert on leadership. I've done all these marvellous things. It's easier to hide behind somebody else, like Shakespeare, for instance, and say, you know. But I didn't shy away from throwing in my own experiences and saying how much I learned from failure,
yes,
as well as success. You learn a lot more from failure than from success. And so I didn't shy away from spelling out where I felt I'd gone wrong or things I could have done better. But I didn't want to just be big noting myself about I am the be all and end all about leadership. But using Shakespeare was a pretty invulnerable sort of weapon, I think.
He's got a distinct advantage, though, in terms of demonstrating leadership qualities and, you know, of course, just creating those other leadership success or failures in the characters that he has. And his great advantage is that language of his. You know, he's the master of English in a way that so few others are not. So he's at a distinct advantage when it comes to formalising for us what is a great moment of leadership, what is, you know, failure, what is cowardice, what is a missed opportunity. And I don't know how, maybe you can tell us how we can sort of connect to that a bit more meaningfully in what we do, because the language is there, you know, for the taking and for the using, I imagine.
Yes. I mean, that kind of speech that I just read is inspirational speech, but the speech of other characters is much more down to earth and less oratorical. And I think what Shakespeare is, not just the language, of course, it's wonderful, and the poetry is wonderful, but even when he's writing prose, it's succinct and character-driven and very revealing about all the individual characters. And so we can learn a lot from the way people talk about their characters, and we can compare them to people we know or situations we know. I think, for instance, Julius Caesar is an absolute wonderful demonstration of failures in leadership, that every character in that play, they are all people of great qualities, and they all have some particular flaw that is a failure in leadership, and that is reflected in the way they speak. If you listen to Caesar talk, it's overblown and narcissistic and grandiose because he has an arrogance and a sense of entitlement that is his undoing.
Mm.
And he has a tin ear. He doesn't see what's going on around him. He doesn't hear people's discontent. He's so wrapped in his own ego. Then you've got someone like Brutus, who has a lot of very reflective speeches, and he's a man of great integrity, but he's a bit too full of his own self-righteousness, so he doesn't listen to other people. He always knows best, and he'll overrule anybody who has a suggestion, because I know best. Whereas Cassius, for instance, is peevish and splenetic and acting out of envy and resentment, which is a very bad place to be coming from if you want to be leading anybody. But he's too deferential to Brutus. And because he knows Brutus is the man of greater integrity, and so Cassius always gives way. And he shouldn't. He should stick to his guns, because actually he's right. He is the older and wiser politician. And then you've got Mark Antony, who is the most successful in the short term, because he's an absolute fantastic opportunist who knows just when to grab power and how to manipulate a mob in a way that Donald Trump would envy. but then
Donald
he blows
Trump
it all.
Doesn't envy anyone.
He blows it all through voluptuousness and laziness, and he throws it all away. So it's not just getting to the top that matters; it's staying there, having the self-discipline and wisdom and flexibility to stay on the top, because someone's always coming up behind you.
But interestingly, on Julius Caesar, and I wonder your reflection on why Shakespeare chose to imbue his Caesar with so many flaws and weaknesses, and to sort of traduce that character in history. And I'm a very, 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 very amateur classicist on this matter. And to us, Caesar is you pretty much put him at the top when it comes to leadership, or even with his flaws. But he imbues him with these weaknesses that are surprising to the classicist. Why do you think he does that?
I think Shakespeare was interested in power struggles, because that was happening all around him. And England was very apprehensive about these power struggles. Elizabeth was in her last years, and she hadn't named a successor. She wouldn't. She was hanging on to power, and she wouldn't give way to any man. She wouldn't marry. She had to be the autocrat. And so no one knew who was going to succeed. And there were fears it might be a Spaniard, or it could be a Frenchman, or it turned out to be a Scot eventually. So everyone was very worried about this, what's going to happen when she pops off. So I think Shakespeare was really intrigued by the power struggles that were happening and people's jockeying for position. And so rather than see Caesar as one of the nine worthies, how he's regarded throughout the Middle Ages and the Tudor period, he saw him as a man of flaws and imperfections and a much more human target. And he makes him almost senile, which yeah. Caesar wasn't. But he wants to show the weakness of someone who doesn't realise it's time to hand on the job to somebody else. He's outstayed his welcome. He's missing things because he's just not with it anymore. And that's a very bad position to be in if you're a leader.
He is capable, though, and even in Shakespeare's play, but of course in the histories that have been written about him, and you write in the book that 90% of leadership is the ability to communicate something that people want. He was very good at doing that. Particularly good. You've had your challenges as leader, and in the book you discuss losing a general manager and the company and the decisions you had to take after that. Talk to us about what you learnt about your leadership capacity, flaws during a period like that. What was revealed?
Yes, that was a fairly interesting little crisis we had with the Bell Shakespeare Company when I was still there. We lost our general manager rather unexpectedly, and our very wise chairperson said, well, why don't you just try running the company without a general manager for a while and see how that works? Try running it by committee, which was a rather radical idea. But so we said, okay, we'll give that a go and see how that spins out. So we asked each part of the company to have its own little committee. And we'd meet once a week, and they'd do reports, and then my fellow artistic director and I would gather all the material and try to run the company. But the first thing we did was ask them all individually to come and speak to us, one at a time, about what they thought was wrong with the company, where it could be better, and how their own job could be better. And that was a very fascinating experience. We got to meet a good half hour to come and talk to us in private, and we recorded all the material, and then when it was all over, we collated it, and we got the whole company together and said, here's some of the feedback you've given us, anonymously, but these are some of the suggestions that came out. And there were some such good suggestions about reshaping the structure of the company, about shifting people's positions into something they were more attuned to or more capable of, and everybody felt empowered by the fact they'd been listened to and acted upon, that their comments meant something. So that was quite a breakthrough for us, and taught us a heck of a lot about the people we were working with, which we hadn't known before. We hadn't asked the questions. So we knew them better as individuals. We knew them better as a working team. And we found after about 3 or 4 months that we needed a general manager. We needed somebody minding the shop while we were out reflecting on what we were doing on the road. So we got a very good person, came up through the ranks to become general manager. And that's, she's still there in that position and doing a wonderful job. So that was a well worthwhile exercise.
Were you always a good listener, or did you have to learn to be a good listener?
I had to learn to listen. I wasn't always, no. When I was younger, I was a bit too brush off. You know.
Yeah.
I know what's best. But eventually you learn, no, I don't always know what's best.
Because that's such a good exercise in listening. And I mean, I've been part of those sorts of so-called, you know, speak truth to power listening exercises, and maybe it's more a reflection of the shark pool newsrooms that I've worked in over the years, that whenever that's happened, it's been a disaster. You know, you walk in going, you don't want to hear this. And if I actually say it, it'll be my head on the chopping block. And it's absolutely true. You see the poor bunnies that walked in and went, oh, yeah, no, I'll tell you what's wrong with the company. And they got shot down. And so we just, you know, learned not to do that. Mm. And in those so-called exercises, you'd learn to come up with the phrases that, you know, that they want to hear, tell them what they want to hear, get out of the room without anything bad happening, and all will be well. I mean, that's familiar, isn't it?
A pointless exercise, isn't it?
Yeah, well, really.
Yeah.
But there are places that see leadership as, well, as a very sort of narrow hierarchical pyramid, right?
That's right.
Yeah. It all just sits up there and I'm down here to serve.
Yeah. It's a very, very old-fashioned and inflexible structure. It's, one has to keep striving for a much more equitable...
But what if people don't want that?
I think people do enjoy being given autonomy. They don't want too much responsibility, perhaps, but autonomy.
Yes. Talk to me about the connection or the separation between those two, autonomy and responsibility.
I guess you have to have a head of a department. You've got maybe four or five people in one area working on something. Someone has to be responsible for decisions within that little group.
Mm.
Otherwise, people are a bit... yes, they want someone to decide, make the decision. Do we do this now, or do we do it next week, or what do we do? And someone has to say, well, we'll do it now. I think that's important, that each person within the structure has to have a degree of responsibility.
You end each chapter where you speak about different plays and different characters and qualities of leadership with a short summary of the leadership qualities that we learn from this moment in Shakespeare. I've just written down a couple of them because I love them, and I'll put them on little note cards pinned over my desk because that's how my mind works. Be there is a repeated one in your book, which is be there. Get down from the office, be there, turn up, be in the room, be part of the mission that apparently you're all there to complete. It's almost remarkable we have to say that out loud, isn't it?
Can I read you a bit more?
Yep.
You don't mind. Just to make that very point, it's a bit more about Henry V, actually,
yes.
where we left off.
You keep coming back to Henry V.
I do, because I said he is the most inspiring of the leaders, the most successful in the short term. I mean, Shakespeare makes the point. At the end of the play, well, after that great battle, he died, and within a few years, Joan of Arc had taken the whole country back, and there was chaos at home, which led to the Wars of the Roses. So actually, was the whole thing worth it? Was it a gigantic disaster, that whole campaign? So as Shakespeare reminds us of, there is the glory and the so-called success, but then there's the price you pay for it. And actually, was it worth all that effort? But just that thing about being there, I'll read you one more little piece from Henry V about, it's the night before the Battle of Agincourt, and Henry actually walks among the troops and listens to them. He walks around the tents and listens to what they're all saying, whereas most generals would stay in their tent and be drawing up their battle plans and getting ready or having a rest or whatever. And he goes and talks to them and listens to them and inspires them individually, one by one. And that, I think, is really worth noting. So the poor condemned at English, like sacrifices by their watchful fires, sit patiently and inly ruminate the morning's danger, and their gesture sad, investing lank, lean cheeks and war-worn coats, presenteth them unto the gazing moon so many horrid ghosts. Oh, now who will behold the royal captain of this ruined band, walking from watch to watch, from tent to tent? Let him cry praise and glory on his head, for forth he goes and visits all his host, bids them good morrow with a modest smile, and calls them brothers, friends, and countrymen. Upon his royal face there is no note how dread an army hath enrounded him, nor doth he dedicate one jot of colour unto the weary and all-watched night. but freshly looks, and overbears a taint with cheerful semblance and sweet majesty, that every wretch, pining and pale before, beholding him, plucks comfort from his looks. A largess universal like the sun, his liberal eye doth give to every one, thawing cold fear. That mean and gentle all behold, as may unworthiness define, a little touch of Harry in the night. Ooh, that's gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Really fantastic.
He was so generous to Henry V. He gave him all the qualities in all different circumstances that you would want for all requirements.
That's right. But that thing about spreading contagious optimism.
That's one my of next point.
Key points. Yes.
You're brilliant. You keep right. anticipating that a leader must spread contagious optimism, which is such a lovely thing. And you can see it from your own bosses. You can see it in yourself when you realise that, yes, you know, like it or not, of course you have a leadership position. Everyone does. And if you come to work tired, exhausted, for perfectly understandable reasons, justifiable reasons even, what's the point when you're supposed to, you know, gird your loins and, you know, once more onto the fray? And, in, you know, my case, 3 hours on air. Lead everyone in with some sort of contagious optimism and you're not, you've just got to, you know, dig in and find it. You have to find it. Can you fake it till you make it?
I think you can often fake it. Yes, you have to. Yes. Especially just before an opening night, you've really got to enthuse everybody that it might seem like we've got a disaster on our hands, but no, it's going to be fantastic. It's going to be great, you know.
How many times have you walked on stage going, this is just fucked, this is not going to work? How many times have you stood in the wings going, ugh?
I remember once in Adelaide, standing on stage just before the curtain went up, and I could hear the audience coming in and settling down, and I thought, this show is so bad, I could just walk off stage now and into the down the back lane and onto the bus. But as I thought that, the curtain started to go up. And I was stuck there like a rabbit in the headlights. I had to go through with it.
That is an amazing moment. I mean, I've had those moments too where, you know, my life is relentlessly driven by the clock, no matter what is going on. You know, when the clock strikes 6 a.m. on News Breakfast, you are on air 3 hours. Hello, good morning, welcome to News Breakfast. And everything is fine. Mm. And in radio now, it's the same. But just the other day, you know, it was 10 past eight. We had nothing to go to air with. We had a few things after 10 a.m., but to get me from 8:30 to 10, like nothing. And no one had answered the phones. We couldn't line anybody up. There were no stories. And I turned to my producer and I said, we could just go home. Just get our bags and just walk out. And just that, I just visualised that moment of just stepping out into the bright autumn sunshine of Melbourne. Mm. It was a beautiful morning. Mm. Just go, and it was, I shouldn't think about that too often. It's enormous. You see why I'm no leader? I am no leader. This is no leader. But I turned up. I was there. Don't procrastinate was another one I wrote down from your book, John.
I think procrastination is a really debilitating thing for people working with you. They really need you to make a decision. So, as I was saying about calculated risks and then taking them, but the more you procrastinate, the more you undo the work ethic of those around you. It's a big danger.
If we're going to talk about leadership lessons from Shakespeare, and we've got all the good ones here, and I do want to speak briefly about Lear, because I know how highly you regard the play of King Lear. But we need to speak about Richard III and the sort of the inverse leadership lessons that we learned from Richard III.
Well, Richard III is the classic psychopath who's acting out of huge grudge and resentment, hatred of the world, and therefore a desire to dominate the world. It's quite a satanic sort of attitude. But of course, he is the product of a time brought up during the Civil War, which was absolutely brutal and devastating. So if you're brought up in that atmosphere and you never know anything about the positive human values, of course, you can become that sort of person. Mm. Not everybody does, of course, but he takes that path. I would say among his weapons are spreading fake news. That's a very, very, very good one. Absolute lack of any kind of moral compass at all.
Oh, now I know why you included him in the book. Oh, I see. I'm so intrigued by your analysis in the book of King Lear. You describe as Shakespeare's greatest play, and you say that you're yet to see a performance of this play that comes near to realising the play's challenges. That's an almost shocking statement.
Well, it is, but it's such a monumental piece of writing, and it is so extreme in its the cruelty, the despair, the dystopian vision, that it's almost unbearable to play or to watch. It takes a lot to bring it off and make it really sort of satisfying in a good way. The challenges are so enormous on the actors and on the audience. But I think it is the greatest play, in my opinion, for that very reason. It dares to look so deep into the abyss and so unsentimentally and saying this is what a really tragic lack of leadership can lead to. And Lear makes so many mistakes that set this whole thing in motion. Basically, the whole structure of the patriarchy, this dominant old man who won't let go, won't give up his position, wants to hang on to all the perks of office without the responsibilities, and then makes the dreadful decision of carving his kingdom up into three parts and giving bits of it away to whoever professes the most affection for him. I mean, it's the classic egotism and egomania and demanding loyalty and affection from people rather than earning it. So he makes all these ghastly mistakes, and it just gets getting worse and worse as all the chickens come home to roost.
We have some time for questions, so if you would like to start thinking about them, and if you would like to come up and stand at the microphone, don't be shy, you'd be most welcome here, then do come up and do that, and we can make some time for them. Who has led you well, John?
I'm trying to think of people in the theatre particularly. I think when I was at I was with the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford for 5 years, and Peter Hall was the resident artistic director, and I think he was a good leader. Not everything he produced was wonderful, but it was of a good level, and he did employ some very good people to work with him. But he did know everybody, and he was very modest in his approach to people, and generous in the way he communicated, and I remember we were doing one production, and it was Macbeth. It was going to be a disaster. We all knew it was going to be a disaster. It was over-designed and far too abstract, and it was not communicating. And he made the mistake of saying at the beginning, now there's only two people in this play. There's Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. It happened to be Paul Scofield and Vivian Merchant, who you couldn't get much better. Because they're the only two real people. The rest of you are all choric figures. So you're not people, you are choric figures, like a Greek chorus. And so we're going to dress you all identically, like Greek statues. And you'll stand there and you will intone your lines in a sort of a sing-song tone rather than be real people. And we did all this thing. And on the dress rehearsal, he set us down before, he said, "Well, chaps, I made a terrible mistake." it was like Biggles talking, you know. "Hey, oh, chaps, we can salvage this thing." He said, "So tomorrow night," he said, "you'll go on and you are not choric figures. You are real people. So grab a costume from somewhere. Grab some sort of accent for your character and just come on and let's see what happens." So the accents range from sort of Edinburgh to Bangladesh, you know. There are people in the weirdest bits of costume they could find. And it was a bit of a fiasco. But at least he admitted that in advance.
I'm wanting to give him points for humility and for changing his mind.
That's right, absolutely. Change your mind and, don't cling to it. Just say, "This is my concept, this is my vision, and I will see it through." No, if you've made a huge mistake, admit it, and then try and fix it. Eventually, the show settled down, and we took it off to Russia after that on tour. And by then, it had got kind of good. We'd sorted out some of the errors, and but it took a while.
I won't forget that you're over there, and I'll come to you in order, but I think you're first, if you'd like to step up. Hello.
Hi. Thank you both for a wonderful conversation. And I'd like to suggest that one of the things that makes both of you amazing leaders is that you are both very humble and you both have humility, which you mentioned just now, Virginia. So thank you.
Thank you, but I can't take that.
Well, exactly. And going from your tweet this morning about which was empowered women empower women, which I love. And I'd like to paraphrase it to say empowered humans empower humans. And this is a very serious question because my son is teaching, he's in year 10 and he's learning, Henry V at school in English. Rather well, I think, overall it's being taught at a pretty good school. But I just feel like the Australian curriculum and New South Wales curriculum in particular, you know, is just, it's really left to the chance of having an amazing and inspiring English teacher if you're lucky. I would love for you to both, as empowered humans, advise and rewrite the Australian curriculum, but especially the English curriculum. What do you think?
Oh, wow. John, I'm leaving that one to you, but, you know.
I didn't quite get the gist of it. Should we rewrite the curriculum, you're saying, or should we...
Yeah. Please rewrite it.
Yeah. Oh.
Well, look, I'm not really familiar enough with the curriculum as it stands, although I sense from what I pick up that, say, Shakespeare and other classics, a lot of poetry is being pushed more for what they call the elite students only, and the other kids don't ever get to see or read any of it. I think that's a big gap. I think so. And at university level too, Shakespeare's relegated to one course of study, but not everybody has to do it or even ever read it at school or university. So I think our English classics are our heritage and everybody should have access to them. I know it can be a hard slog sometimes. People say, oh, it's not relevant anymore. What they're really saying is it's a bit too hard. Of course, Shakespeare is as relevant as mayhem, murder, lust, teenage love, whatever, families. As long as those things are relevant, then Shakespeare is relevant. But people think, oh, it's just too hard, it's too much of a slog, it's not about me, it's not about now. So I think one has to... I would hope that we could redress that in time, that the syllabus could be more inclusive. But I think the real problem is there seems to be so much on the syllabus, so much stuff to get through, and teachers are so harassed for time and obligated that it just seems to be... It goes into the too hard basket, is what I'm picking up.
It's true. I'd be very reluctant to make a teacher's hard working life any harder and any more crowded than it is. So I agree with you there. I think what makes this situation really tough is that while we have known for a long time about the huge inequalities in our lives anyway, and has shown up even in greater relief by the pandemic, in the education system in particular, so much of this comes back to the good fortune of the parents that you have. And, I hate to even say that out loud. And, of course, it puts more responsibility on parents. But, you know, we take that on. And if you're lucky enough to have the kind of parent that clearly you are, well, then you'll be doing that at home. You know, you'll be introducing work. You'll be reading to them. You'll be taking them out to see the theatre if you can afford it. But, again, it takes us back again and again to the fortune and misfortune of the country you're born in, the money that you're born into, the privilege you're born into or not. And I hate to acknowledge that, but I think that has to be acknowledged here as part of that. You're number two for the question, if you'd like to come across. Hello.
The answer may well be read the book, but could you comment on how Shakespeare depicts women as leaders? Because it appears that they either have to be dressed as men or act through men.
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. Did you all hear the question? How does Shakespeare, does he see women as leaders? I think, you understand, of course, that in his day there were no female actors on stage. Women weren't allowed on stage, so boys and men played all the roles, all the female roles. Young men would play, boys would play like Juliet or Rosalind or Viola. Older men would play the mature female parts. And I think he was struggling, I believe, to give women a voice. His early female characters, when he's a young playwright, tend to be, you can see them being played by male actors. They're pretty butch sort of women. There's Joan of Arc or Queen Margaret or Volumnia or Tamora, Queen of the Goths. They're pretty masculine sort of characters. Then he goes into these sexy comedies where the girl dresses up as a boy, and which is a neat way of getting around the fact that it's a male actor anyway. But also I think he's saying that women can only have power when they dress up as men. Partly it's for safety when they're travelling, but for other reasons too. Portia dresses up as a judge to pass judgment on Shylock. So she's empowered by putting on the judge's costume and becoming a man. And he's trying to, I think, give women a voice through putting them into male attire. But then later, the women do assume, I think, the greatest moral authority in the plays. When you get to characters like Desdemona, Cordelia, especially Hermione in The Winter's Tale, they are the ones who have real integrity and honesty and strength and resilience, and it's the men who let them down through jealousy and rage and abuse. And yet the women are always, are the ones that you look to for what I would call the greatest qualities of leadership. They display, even though they suffer for it, they do project those qualities, and the men are, in most cases, humbled by that and realise. Even early on in the comedies, Rosalind actually teaches Orlando what love is all about, because he's running around writing love poems on the trees. She says, no, it's not about that. It's about being punctual. It's being reliable. It's not about writing poetry. And in Love's Labour's Lost, the four young women in that say to the men, look, stop mooning around being in love. Go away, grow up, and come back in a year's time. And then if you're serious, then we'll consider you. So even early on, the women are the more sensible, more pragmatic, and the men have to learn a lot from the women.
But you've also got that figure arching over all of it, and perhaps to the side, but nonetheless central, and that's the figure of Elizabeth the First herself,
yes,
major leader.
That's right. She was obviously, the fact that she was the top of the tree made it, gave women more, if you like, presence. And English women were known for being a bit more socially free and outspoken than women on the continent. There were female poets and writers, artists, musicians. But of course, they didn't always get much recognition. Even into the 20th century, we had people like, or 19th century, people like George Eliot or Henry Handel Richardson having to use male names to get published. So it wasn't just, it's been a long, long process. It wasn't just in Shakespeare's time. It's been a battle ever since for women to get that recognition that we're talking about.
I want to say thank you for inspiring theatre students, including myself. My quick question is, what does inspire you as an actor other than Shakespeare?
Oh.
Thank you.
Shakespeare is cool, but...
Yes. But John, what about the rest?
True. I would say second to Shakespeare, if I were choosing a career path, I'd go for Chekhov. I find the most sort of wonderfully compassionate and deep-searching author. And then perhaps Molière for his wit and flamboyance and great sense of satire. But if I can come back to that previous question, I think the only speech I can think of that might be useful, you can't buy it literally, but it's the opening speech from Henry V. Again, and it's not Henry talking, it's the chorus talking. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. He's talking about creating something out of nothing. He's saying, here we've got just bare boards, a few actors, a couple of rusty props, and we're going to create this great spectacle. So I think that would be a good keynote for any leader to say, I haven't got much, not much in the kitty, not much, but we're going to, here's what we've got, and we're going to use it in a way that's amazing.
I think that's the perfect note on which to end our conversation with John Bell this afternoon. Please thank him again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.